Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Revolution Radio. Today is Wednesday, October 24th, 2012. And this is Dr. Kate broadcasting live from the desert, where it is quite beautiful weather right now. We're going to have another short show tonight, and I'm going to start out with just a few things that I think you'll be very interested in. We finally made it through all of these debates, and I think that they had a major change on the public's perception of Mitt Romney and Barack Obama. Of course, all of us knew that we would see Obama for who he really is if he was just without his teleprompter, and sure enough, we did. Whether he was stoned out on drugs or whether he was withdrawing from drugs or whether he had an earpiece in, particularly in the third debate, he behaved poorly and showed his juvenile lack of understanding of the issues, showed the media's absolute alliance with Obama and how he's gotten this far is primarily due to the media, showed his lack of planning or lack of ideas for anything new that will happen if he's elected again, although we know what his plan will be, and it's not just exactly what Mitt Romney said, it's essentially his plan for the takedown of America. We can look at numbers, but we know that's where he's been headed. And of course, as a usurper, if he is quote-unquote elected again, it just reinforces that it's okay to break the Constitution, and good luck, you know, being someone who's interested in eligibility after the election if he gets elected. On the other hand, if he's denied re-election, we at least have a natural-born citizen in the office. We know that Mr. Romney is, you know, by far as well the corporatist choice. We know that our struggles to keep our country free and to reestablish our republic are still going to go on. And so we have our work cut out for us. If Obama loses, the Article 2 super PAC is going to continue to do work no matter what, and in particular what we will be focusing on is to undo everything that Obama has done in his 4 years, and that's going to require a lot of work, a lot of pressuring of Congress. Of course, if the Senate remains in Democrat hands, none of this will see the light of day, but we will have to continue to make sure that the very damaging legislation and any treaties that he signed are overdone and withdrawn. And I don't care whose feelings get hurt, Obama was not a legitimate president. The other thing that that the Article 2 super PAC will be doing if Mr. Romney wins is to make sure that there is a vetting process from now on so that this will never happen again, so that the political parties will not be allowed to make their choice and stick it to everybody in the country, particularly if that choice is unconstitutional. So we've been developing some materials, in fact, a checklist that might be interesting for all of you. It's like a report card or scorecard on who of all the presidential candidates this year are natural-born citizens and who are not. Now, we know that Mr. Obama is going to be, you know, definitely not a natural-born citizen. Interestingly enough, we uncovered some questions about Gary Johnson until we can get more information about his father and where he was born, he was adopted, and so forth. And we're poring over their records right now. There's sufficient concern to suggest that there's a question as to whether Gary Johnson is a natural-born citizen. We also have a naturalized U.S. citizen who was born in Guyana and had parents over in the Middle East, but actually sued the Federal Election Commission to try to get access to the Federal Election Commission funding, the presidential funding, and was denied based on the fact that he was not a natural-born citizen. That's a very interesting court case that that came up just recently, and in which he lost, Mr. Hassan lost. So we've got Mitt Romney, who is definitely a natural-born citizen. He was not born in Mexico. His father was. His father was naturalized, so there's not a question that he is a natural-born citizen, and so are his children. Virgil Goode, some of the others, most of them are natural-born citizens. It's, like I say, it was kind of a surprise to find out about Gary Johnson. I think people who are throwing their Ron Paul vote to Gary Johnson might want to think about that and do a little bit of research. What we don't want is another non-natural-born citizen. But what it also shows, like, say, for example, and if you look at this from the standpoint of the cabal that's controlling everything, the financial cabal and so forth, and we won't go into details because I assume that the audience here is aware of what we've been talking and writing about for the last few years. But if we assume that they're behind every one of the candidates, even though they may be favoring Romney right now, we can think that if Gary Johnson is not a natural-born citizen, he's up there too. But what would have happened if we had voted for a third party this year is the cabal would have had all their bases covered. Johnson would be one of them, Romney would be one of them, Obama would be one of them. But I think the most significant piece that has happened for us in the last 4 years is Obama has been so upfront about his objectives that he has not only exposed the left for who they really are, let's not call them liberals. Liberals is too good a word for really who they are, and it gives them a pass. These are the leftists, which took over the Democrats and the rhinos are another story, but the leftists are the ones who've been exposed. Their bankrupt policies have been on the run and on the rise here in our country for the last 35 to 40 years, and they've had setbacks. But Obama was supposed to be where they ended up with control for the next 50 years, and it's been a bomb. Their plans have shown them to be nothing but tax hikers, misogynist, racist, classist, elitist, and really not having much to do with anything that our country stands for. So in the process, Obama has exposed his cabal funding, the ties with the Rockefellers and George Soros and the Rothschilds and the Europeans and the drugs and the guns. The Muslim Brotherhood, that's a whole other story, as you probably know, and I mentioned this last week. In 2008, Obama received hundreds of millions of dollars in illegal funding from the Middle East. And as a result, the way he's paid it back is he's overthrown Middle East governments and handed them over to the Muslim Brotherhood. Hence, we got Benghazi, where four of our people were killed, including an ambassador to the United States, the first time in over 30 years that one of our ambassadors has been killed. But the Benghazi issue is significant. They've been caught red-handed. I mentioned last week that Benghazi, you know, you put this all together, and I'm drawing a lot of this from the current spate of emails that's been released and others, that the Benghazi situation was supposed to be a kidnapping of the U.S. ambassador and the staff and rescue by the Obama administration so that Obama can crow that he's saved the world in the Rose Garden as a ploy to win re-election. Whether the contract that was set up to kidnap Ambassador Stevens was bought out or found out by another faction of the cabal, it went horribly wrong. Why did Obama skip his last several intelligence briefings? Because he's been avoiding them because he didn't want to be in the loop, if you will, on knowing anything about increasing security problems in the uprun to the anniversary of September 11th. He didn't want to be in that loop at all, so he could claim ignorance. But the emails released today and yesterday just definitively prove that the White House knew within hours that this was an act of terror, and Al-Qaeda was involved, and some other Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups were involved. And Lame Cherry has a great discussion of, you know, what it might have been like for the conspirators in the State Department and whoever else pulled this off to essentially watch this thing unfold in real time and find out that, in fact, it had gone terribly wrong. So Mitt Romney, I was looking forward to him raising the issue of Benghazi in the last debate, but it turns out that he must have found out that these emails exist because Obama was loaded for bear, to ready to defend why he didn't say what he should have said or said what he shouldn't have said at that time. Hat tip to Michelle's mirror, Michelle Obama's mirror blog spot, which is a terrific site. And Romney just avoided that because he sidestepped it because these emails were going to come out. So in a way it was charitable so that Obama couldn't be caught lying more, but Obama is caught, you know, red-handed in this mess. So all of this by way of saying, and I see Tenacity's in the chat room. Good evening. Relax in terms of a headache. Sorry you're feeling that way, but thank you. Perhaps what I'll be talking about a little bit later, Terry, will help. I'm going to do a discussion of the 23rd Psalm. But anyway, it's an interesting time. If you look at the polls going on right now, you know, it's still very, very close. The media talking heads are sort of beginning to shift their tone and describe how close the race is and so forth. And I don't know if any of you are watching the election returns, but it's going to be very interesting to see people like Chris Matthews and how they respond. Dick Morris is pretty convinced that Romney is going to win. Lots of other people are convinced. The always accurate Colorado State University poll, I think it's the CU poll, has predicted a landslide for Romney. Folks who live in Ohio have talked about openly about how probably the polls are incorrect because of people sort of having fun with pollsters on the phone. You've also got to factor in Obama's fragile ego, and if he's losing by as much as they say he is, he'd probably flip out before the world, have a meltdown before the world, and so they've got to protect him, but he is not winning. His campaign stump speeches remind me now of George Bush, the first George Bush when he was against Clinton. Remember, Bush started calling everybody a bozo and so forth. Turns out he was right about Al Gore. I think he called Al Gore bozo. But in any case, it just degenerated and degraded to name-calling and small things. And, I know you know in your mind the picture of our ambassador as he was being dragged around the streets of Benghazi. And what the Obama team effectively did was take a little poster of Big Bird and wave it in front of that picture of our ambassador killed. And this is such a stark contrast, but that's exactly what happened. Obama got caught. You know, he probably always had his pants down, but this time he got caught publicly with that. And it really just a remarkable shift in the last several weeks. So the momentum is on the Republican side. Regardless of, you know, I swear, sometimes deliberate attempts to lose elections by some of the candidates, the momentum is there. And but the polls are still going close, so in any way, we're very close to the election, so I just don't think there's any more time for any more false flags because people have been alerted to false flags. And clearly Benghazi was supposed to be a false flag, but it was supposed to put Obama in a better position, just like he could beat his chest about bin Laden, killing bin Laden's corpse again, and so forth. So things are blowing up. It's like people have hunkered down. I know a lot of people that I work with, a lot of the elderly community have, many of them Democrats, have just plain decided to switch votes. And so it's going to be very interesting to see switch sides, to see what transpires. So anyway, that's going on. Let me see. Donald Trump came out with his quote-unquote surprise today. I'm not disappointed in Trump. Of course, we hope that he had more than what he said he had. Maybe he still does have Obama's transcripts, but in case you hadn't heard it, he offered $5 million to go to any of Obama's charities if he would just produce his applications for Harvard and Columbia. Not his grades. Everybody knew he had lousy grades, but his applications for Columbia. So I think that is very interesting, because what's that going to show you? That Obama took advantage of everything, and instead of getting in on his own, he had lousy grades, he applied as a foreign student. And we've all suspected of that, and I think we're entitled to the adverse inference that Obama was a foreign student, that's how he got in, and when you think about all the covering up of everything, that's probably it. I want to mention the Obama eligibility cases just for a second, because we've only got a couple of people who are still working on the issue, and of course one of them is Orly Tates. And there's a lot to say here, but suffice it to say, and I'm going to give this credit to Texas Darling, who said years ago that she felt that the whole issue of the birth certificate and so forth was essentially a distraction point to distract from the adoption of Obama as an Indonesian, by an Indonesian citizen. So, and remember, people died regarding his passport, so it's very likely that he retained his Indonesian citizenship. He still retains his British citizenship. And that this was, the whole various birth in Hawaii and so forth was just a ruse to cover that citizenship up. There is no record of him naturalizing, but even if he had naturalized, he still could not run for president. And so I think this is again just another ruse. So I congratulate everyone who's faced this justice system. We now pretty much have proved that the justice system is corrupt, and or that Obama has threatened so many people, and or that none of them know the Constitution and they just blow it off and are just winging it up there as these judges, which probably all of those things are true. Just going to read a couple of comments from the chat room. Gary Johnson said in the third party debate last night that he welcomed people to waste their vote for him. And there is also a question of what is Trump setting up or distracting. Now, Trump is an interesting guy. You don't know if he's working for the Democrats or the Republicans. But you do know that he's working for himself. So any, you know, it's very clear any kind of attention he can get, would be good. I had personally thought that he was going to offer Obama a place on Celebrity Apprentice since he'd be out of a job in January, but not. Notice that Trump's deadline is October 31st, you know, Halloween trick-or-treat. Does Trump actually have Obama's application documents? Maybe he does. Maybe this is setting that up. Right now, if you look at who this is hurting, it's not hurting the Romney campaign. The Romney campaign is not a part of this. It is reminding everybody that Obama has spent $3 million hiding his records, that was his first executive order, and that despite promising to have the most transparent administration, whatever, nobody knows who this guy is. So it's very interesting. And so we'll see what happens, but what is it possibly a distraction for? I'm not sure. I think those are always good questions, and I think this is a benefit of what has happened the last 4 years, or we're asking those questions. We didn't think like that before. Well, some of us certainly did, but I know I didn't. And, you know, when you begin to look at politicians' actions and saying, now, wait a minute, what does that mean? What's behind it? Who does this benefit? What's it distracting from? What it could lead to? Who does it expose? You kind of get a clear view. We learned a long time ago that anything Obama says that he's doing, he's actually doing the opposite. And remember how quickly they came down on the Honduran government for stopping their president from illegally proposing ballot measures and so forth, and they got him out. And it, quickly, Obama and Clinton called it a coup because, you know, let's focus on that coup as opposed to the coup that had just occurred in the United States. But Obama has a record of running from, you know, the Iranian protesters, for example. He got them all killed. And Honduras, he lost a lot of, questions were raised then. But you can see now, when you think about what's going on in the Middle East, whatever Obama told you, it was just the opposite. So we have every right to adversely infer his intentions, his truthfulness, and where he's going with this. So, anyway, that's all for pretty much of an introductory remark. I'm going to just take just a little break so we can get to our next section. And Let me just play a brief song, and then I'm going to spend the rest of the hour talking about the 23rd Psalm. Be right back. Welcome back, everybody. I hope you enjoyed that song, America. I just had a quick announcement for those of you who are listening and not in the chat room. The movie, quote, The Hope and Change, unquote, is available for free viewing on Hulu. Here's the URL, www.hulu.com/watch/409925. That's www.hulu.com/watch409925. It's for free, and we don't know how long it'll be up there, but we encourage everyone to take a look at that movie. Pass it on to everybody you know. Okay, good evening, guests, and good evening, Vet. Nice to see you. Thank you for joining us. We had just a brief half hour or so talking about the updates of the day, the false flags, the Benghazi, the polls, Obama. One last piece. If Obama loses, we're going to have to still watch out between Election Day and January 21st. There are a number of UN treaties, the one on arms, the law of the sea, and the one on taxing the Internet, the UN taxing the Internet. All of these are deals that are going to be signed between now and the end of the year. Obama's going to be pressuring Congress to sign these things. And it could be bad for the Democrats, so they might be out for maximum revenge. We know that Obama will be out for maximum revenge. After he stops crying, he's going to be furious, and he will be doing as much as he can to still do damage to our country. So heads up, everyone needs to keep aware. Yeah, it's a big crowd tonight, Vet. I've been on and off the air for a little while on Wednesday evenings, Waldner, Wednesday evenings Revolution Radio. So I don't think the following has really picked back up again, and trying some new things as well. So our Walls in Our Mind show is really taking off. That's tomorrow night, beginning at 6 Pacific. Hi, everybody else who's there. And thank you for joining us very much. So, sorry you missed the political piece, because we're now going to move into a discussion of Psalm 23. Now, the reason I'm doing this, not only is it one of my favorite psalms, if you've ever looked at the psalms, they're really, not exactly lamentations, but these are the poetry and discussions written during the time in the desert. And really, you could probably break Psalms up into four parts. I won't go through that. And the other reason I'm reading this tonight is, you've heard the term sheeple and how we are being led around like sheeple. And Psalm 23 is really... it's really about herding sheep, and it's really about the flock of sheep, which we are gods. And if we want to be sheeple, if we want to be sheep, we need to be following God and letting Him carry our hands and carry us through here, not following around some politician like a sheeple. But there's no shame in being a sheep. And so I want to read this piece. And it's very symbolic. It's actually about shepherding. It's the shepherd psalm, Psalm 23. I'll read the psalm through first and then go into the discussion. The shepherd psalm. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. He restoreth my soul. He leadeth me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil, my cup runneth over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. At my mother's funeral and at a number of other funerals, these were the psalms that were read. This next piece that I'm going to read is by an Episcopal bishop, and he's talking about what this psalm could have meant to a sheep herder. And when you listen to the discussion, yes, talking about the mechanics of herding sheep, but if you think about what I first said about us being really the flock of the Lord, what these things might say to you about how you live your life and who you follow and how and what you see is done for you in the miracle of the Lord's hand. Old Fernando de Alfonso was a Basque sheep herder employed by a big Nevada sheep outfit. He was rated as one of the best sheep rangers in the state, and rightly so, for back of him were at least 20 generations of Iberian shepherds. But de Alfonso was more than a sheep herder. He was a patriarch of his guild, the various traditions and secrets which have been handed down from generation to generation. Despite a long absence from his homeland, he was, when I knew him, still full of legends, the mysteries, the religious fervor of his native hills. I sat with him one night under a clear sky, his sheep bedded down beside a sparkling pool of water. As we were preparing to curl up in our blankets, he suddenly began a dissertation in a jargon of Greek and Basque. When he had finished, I asked him what he had said. In reply, he began to quote in English the 23rd Psalm. There on the desert, I learned the shepherd's literal interpretation of this beautiful poem. David and his ancestors, said Delfonso, knew sheep and their ways, and David has translated a sheep's musing into simple words. The daily repetition of this psalm fills the sheep herder with reverence for his calling. Our guild takes this poem as a lodestone to guide us. It is our bulwark when days are hot or stormy, when nights are dark, when wild animals surround our bands. Many of its lines are the statements of the simple requirements and actual duties of a Holy Land shepherd, whether he lives today or followed the same calling 6,000 years ago. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Sheep instinctively know, said Delfonso, that before they have been folded down for the night, the shepherd has planned out their grazing for the morrow. It may be that he will take them back to the same range. It may be that he will go in a new grazing ground. They do not worry. His guidance has been good in the past, and they have faith in the future because they know he has their well-being in view. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. Sheep graze from about 3:30 in the morning until about 10. Then they lie down for the 3 or 4 hours and rest. When they are contentedly chewing their cuds, the shepherd knows that they are putting on fat. Consequently, the good shepherd starts his flock out in the early hours on the rougher herbage, moving on through the morning to the richer, sweeter grasses, and finally coming to a shady place for the forenoon rest in fine green pastures, the best grazing of the day. Sheep resting in such happy surroundings feel contentment. He leadeth me beside the still waters. Every shepherd knows that the sheep will not drink gurgling water. There are many small springs in the high hills of the Holy Land, whose waters run down the valleys only to evaporate in the desert sun. Although the sheep need water, they will not drink from these fast-flowing springs and streams. The shepherd must find a place where rocks or erosion have made a little pool, or else he fashions one with his hands, a pocket sufficient to hold at least a bucket full. He restoreth my soul. He leadeth me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. In the Holy Land, each sheep takes his place in the grazing line in the morning and keeps the same position through the day. Once during the day, however, each sheep leaves its place and goes to the shepherd, whereupon the shepherd stretches out his hand and rubs the animal's nose and ears, scratches its chin, whispers affectionately into its ears. The sheep, meanwhile, rubs its cheek against his face. After a few minutes of this communion with the master, the sheep returns to his place in the feeding line. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. There is an actual valley of the shadow of death in Palestine, and every sheep herder from Spain to Dalmatia knows of it. It is south of Jericho Road, leading from Jerusalem to the Dead Sea, and it is a narrow defile through a mountain range. Climactic and grazing conditions make it necessary for the sheep to be moved through this valley for seasonal feeding each year. The valley is 4.5 miles long. Its side walls are over 1,500 feet high in places, and it is only 10 or 12 feet wide at the bottom. Travel through the valley is dangerous because its floor has gullies 7 or 8 feet deep. Actual footing on solid rock is so narrow in many places that a sheep cannot turn around, and it is an unwritten law of the shepherd that flocks must go up the valley in the morning hours and down toward eventide, lest flocks meet in the defile. About halfway through the valley, the walk crosses from one side to the other at a place where the path is cut in two by an 8-foot gully. One side of the gully is about 18 inches higher than the other. The sheep must jump across it. The shepherd stands at the break and coaxes or forces the sheep to make the leap. If a sheep slips and lands in the gully, the shepherd's rod is brought into play. The old-style crook circles a large sheep's neck or a small sheep's chest, and the animal is lifted to safety. If a more modern crook is used, the sheep is caught about the hoofs and lifted up to safety. Many wild dogs lurk in the shadow of the valley looking for prey. The shepherd, skilled in throwing his staff, uses it as a weapon. Thus the sheep have learned to fear no evil in the valley of the shadow of death, for their master is there to protect them from harm. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. David's meaning is a simple one when conditions in the Holy Land sheep ranges are known. Poisonous plants which are fatal to grazing animals abound. Each spring, the shepherd must be constantly alert. When he finds the plants, he takes his mattock and goes ahead of the flock, grubbing out every stalk and root he can see. As he digs out the stalks, he lays them upon little stone pillars, some of which were built by shepherds in the Old Testament days, and by the morrow they are dry enough to burn. When the pasture is free from poisonous plants, the sheep are led into it, and in the presence of their plant enemies, they eat in peace. Thou anointest my head with oil, my cup runneth over. At every sheepfold there is a big earthen bowl of olive oil and a large jar of water. As the sheep come in for the night, they are led to a gate. The shepherd lays his rod across the gateway, just above the backs of the sheep. As each sheep passes, he quickly examines it for briars in the ears, snags in the cheek, or weeping of the eyes from dust or scratches. When such conditions are found, he drops the rod across the sheep's back, and it steps out of line. Each sheep's wounds are carefully cleaned. The shepherd dips his hand into the olive oil and anoints the injury. A large cup is dipped into a jar of water, kept cool by evaporation in the unglazed pottery, and is brought over, never half full, but always overflowing. The sheep will sink his nose into the water clear to the eyes, if fevered, and drink until it's fully refreshed. When all the sheep are at rest, the shepherd places his staff within reach in case it is needed during the night. Then he wraps himself in his woolen robe and lies down across the gateway, facing the sheep, for his night's repose. So after all the care and protection the shepherd has given it, a sheep may well soliloquize in the twilight, as translated into the words by David, "Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever." By James Pike, an Episcopal bishop. I think this has many, many spiritual understandings. I think this shows us who is leading us and who we should follow. When we step out of line and follow the thinking of man or our own minds, probably get off the path and sometimes fall into deep gullies. I think this is very much where we are right now in terms of the mess and confusion we see out there. We've got to get back in line so that, yes, when we walk through the valley of the shadow of death, we will fear no evil because we know He is with us. I invite you to listen to this show broadcast over again, in particular this discussion of the 23rd Psalm. I'll read it in its entirety before we close again. It's the Shepherd's Psalm, a Psalm of David. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. He restoreth my soul. He leadeth me in the paths of righteousness for His name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for Thou art with me. Thy rod and Thy staff, they comfort me. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil. My cup runneth over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Good night, everybody. Thank you for joining us. Please don't forget to join us tomorrow night for Walls in Our Minds, a special show. It begins at 6 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Mountain. And have a great evening. Take care.
What if the armies of the Lord picked up and dusted off their swords, vowed to set the captive free and not let Satan have one more? What if the church, for heaven's sake, finally stepped up to the plate, took a stand upon God's promise and stormed hell's rusty gates? What if His people prayed?